From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is David Rothkopf. He's CEO and editor of the Foreign Policy Group, which publishes Foreign Policy Magazine. And we're coming to you from his office in downtown Washington. A prolific writer, David is the author of the recently published book, National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. We had the pleasure of talking with David a few years ago about his previous book, Power Inc., the epic rivalry between big business and government and the reckoning that lies ahead. And we're delighted to welcome him back to the show to discuss the ideas in his new book as world leaders grapple with combating terrorism and climate change. In addition to being an internationally acclaimed author, David Rothkopf is a leading expert on international affairs and national security. He served as Deputy Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade Policy in the Clinton administration. He's also President and CEO of Garton Rothkopf, an international advisory firm. Mr. Rothkopf is also a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and serves on numerous advisory boards dealing with global leadership and development. In his most recent book, National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear, David Rothkopf examines the presidencies of George W. Bush and Barack Obama, seeking to understand how each leader and the administration around him sought to deal and cope with the aftermath of the terror attacks of September 11, 2001. He finds things to admire as well as to criticize in both presidents, one Republican, one Democrat, and respects the difficulties of the circumstances both Mr. Bush and Mr. Obama have faced in this post-9/11 world. Well, David Rothkopf, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Well, David, I was intrigued by a recent essay that you wrote called Our Reaction to Terrorism is More Dangerous Than the Terrorists. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, I think it's true on several levels. On one level, we've had political leaders in the United States respond in a very self-interested way, and by self-interested, I mean in a way that serves their own personal self-interest as opposed to our national interest, to the terrorism to gain attention. And they've done it in a way that stirs up anger, stirs up resentment between peoples, and plays directly into the hands of the terrorist. Because remember, the goal of the terrorist is it's not to kill a few people or to blow up a building. It's to spread terror. So in order for their work to be effective, somebody's got to pick up and build on the action and make the threat seem bigger than it is and build on the anger that underlies it and maybe even increase the alienation between the groups that are at conflict. When Donald Trump stands up and says, let's build a database of Muslims, how do you think that plays in the Muslim world? Do you think that plays in the interests of the United States or does it play in the interests of the terrorists? It's very clear. It plays in the interest of the terrorists. When Governor Chris Christie, who's also running for president, says it's wrong for the president of the United States to deal with a small issue like climate change, he ought to be dealing with a big issue like terrorism, it turns our priorities upside down. But then there's another reason. The other reason that our reaction is more dangerous than terrorists is that the reaction of all the major states that actually can do anything about this has been uncoordinated. And each one of the states has acted in their self-interest. So Russia's in Syria with one agenda. The U.S. is in Syria with another agenda. The British are going into Syria. The French are in Syria. The Iranians are in Syria. Everybody's in Syria, but every single party has a slightly different interest. And what that leads to is potential conflict between those parties, as well as an ineffective campaign against the terrorists. And, you know, it's bad enough to have to deal with terrorism, but if you end up with growing tension between, you know, major powers like the United States and Russia that can lead to different kinds of conflicts, then the world is doubly dangerous.
Indeed. We'll get back to reaction to terrorism later in the program. But let's go right to the point you made, turning now to Syria. We take note that U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter recently stated that the United States will boost its military campaigns in Iraq and Syria by deploying additional special operations forces, approximately 200, and opening a new front against the so-called Islamic State. Now, of course, we note that the British have expanded airstrikes into Syria, where they were previously confined to Iraq. The question is, David Rothkopf, does the Obama administration, in your view, have a strategy to deal with the rise of the so-called Islamic State? Some critics, especially Republican members of Congress, are saying that it does not.
It does not. There's no evidence that it does. A strategy implies that there is a long-term way to achieve the goal that they've set. They've set a goal. They said they want to achieve the degradation and destruction of the Islamic State. But there is literally no expert that I have met in the Pentagon, in the intelligence community, in other governments, who believes that you can destroy the Islamic State simply by airstrikes, that believes you can destroy the Islamic State without addressing the political problems that help create the Islamic State or the economic problems that help create the Islamic State. And we, frankly, are doing very little in all of those areas. What it looks like the United States is doing right now is just enough action to create the illusion of some kind of progress and resolve without actually producing any material results. That's holding action. It's political. And I think that's the goal. If you ask me, what is the goal of the United States in Syria right now? It's to keep a lid on things until this administration is over and let the problem be picked up by the next one.
Of course, President Obama would certainly dispute that, saying that he came into office to pull out of the region.
Right, and pulling out of the he did, and I think every single thing that President Obama did, he did earnestly and well intentioned with the goal of ending the wars in the region. But let's look at the results. Let's look at Afghanistan. Are we better off in Afghanistan? The government in Afghanistan controls just the area in and around the capital. The Taliban is on the rise. The risk of meltdown in that country is as great, if not greater, than it was when Obama came into the country, despite the fact that we doubled down in the number of troops there. Let's look at Iraq. Iraq was more stable before the United States pulled its troops out of there under the Obama administration. And it has now not only melted down, but part of the meltdown has produced the Islamic State, which has spread over into Syria. He didn't take action in Syria because he wanted to avoid an Iraq-like problem. Syria has now melted down to the point that not only has it spread its problems into Iraq, ISIS now exists in Afghanistan, ISIS exists in North Africa, ISIS-affiliated groups exist around the world. It's the fastest-growing brand in terrorism. But beyond that, you now have refugees flowing into Europe. And what's happening with the refugee flows? Not only are they putting pressure on Europe, and not only do they come with certain security risks, but they're feeding the rise of the right wing in Europe, whether it's the National Front in France or the Northern Alliance in Italy or right-wing groups in Austria or Hungary or other countries or Greece. So what does all that do? That weakens the EU. By weakening the EU, we're weakening our strongest ally there. So the president may have done things earnestly and well-intentioned. They're just not working.
It sounds like you're saying what some critics of President Obama have said, which is that you do need a credible threat of force sometimes in order to achieve peace. And so for that, you do need some troops on the ground.
You don't need a credible threat of force. You actually need to use force sometimes. Does that mean that the invasion of Iraq was the right thing to do? No, the invasion of Iraq was terrible. It was a catastrophe for the United States. But to say, look, here was a use of force that was incredibly stupid and damaging, and therefore we must never use force again, is also not the right answer. We have to be very, very, very careful about using it. Use it only when that is the only available option. But when you do, use it in a way that's actually going to produce a result. Because, you know, when I go and talk to people in the Pentagon off the record, one of the things that I get from them is that they hate more than anything else to be asked to fight a war halfway, be asked to take the risks that are associated with war, to send young men and women into combat or into dangerous situations where they can lose their lives, when they know that the tactics we are employing or the absence of a strategy is going to mean that the loss of those lives is for nothing. And I have to say, given our strategic weakness at the moment and given the impotence of the tactics that we're employing, we are putting a lot of lives at risk with very low likelihood of a positive return.
We'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
Here's a quick quiz. What do the letters LTATOMLAW stand for? We know the answer, right? Listen to Akwe Thompson on Nightline Africa Weekends. Add to that 16 and 18 UTC on VOA, and we have a perfect score. That was easy.
Welcome back to Press Conference USA. Our guest is David Rothkopf. He's CEO and editor of Foreign Policy Magazine. His most recent book is National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. Well, David Rothkopf, back to the strategy in Syria or lack thereof, as you indicated. Talk about how Russia's intervention in Syria has changed the calculus in reaching a political settlement, and particularly now in light of the Turkish shooting down of a Russian warplane.
Well, I think a lot of Americans look at Russia's intervention, and their first reaction, and this has been the administration's reaction, is they're making a terrible mistake. They're going to get caught in another quagmire. And I think, frankly, that we've been essentially projecting onto the Russians the goals that we've had and said, well, if they're trying to achieve those goals, they're not going to be successful. But those aren't the Russian goals. Russia has essentially one primary goal and one secondary goal when they go into Syria. The first goal is they want to either prop up the Assad regime or make sure that whatever the successor regime is one that's acceptable to them. They're doing this with the Iranians. They're going to get their way. By having intervened, by being there, by not leaving until they have their way, we know that the next regime in Damascus is going to be Assad or Assad light. And that's important to the Russians as a local issue because they're afraid of the spread of Islamist extremists into the Caucasus. That's goal number one. Goal number two is that if they project force and look stronger in the region, that's going to help them geopolitically. Now, as it happens, if they don't actually succeed in stabilizing all of Syria, which is the U.S. goal, but is not necessarily the Russian goal, what happens? Refugees keep flowing into Europe. What happens if refugees flow into Europe? Nationalist and right-wing parties rise. What happens if those parties rise? They don't want to be part of the EU. They weaken the EU. By weakening the EU, Russia sees its primary rival on the world stage weakened. So the game that Putin is playing looks to me more likely to be successful than it does to a lot of other people, because his goals are not the goals I think people are attributing to him.
Of course, you mentioned President Assad of Syria. He had cracked down on his own people, and they took up arms, many of them defectors from the army, called themselves then the Free Syria Army. And of course, we know what happened since then. Things have deteriorated. And of course, Russia came in to prop up Bashar al-Assad. So he is the sticking point at this point. And even President Obama said recently in Paris that he doesn't believe that Vladimir Putin's commitment to Assad would shift anytime soon. So, you know, where do we stand? Because many people acknowledge that unless the Sunni states, the Sunni Gulf Arab states and Turkey can really get involved and degrade ISIS, ISIL, Daesh, however you want to call this terrorist group, they will not be defeated. But they're, of course, as concerned, if not more so, with the presence of Bashar al-Assad, who is propped up by their arch enemy, Iran. How do you see this playing
out?
Well,
I think you've summarized the problem extremely well, and it goes back to the point I was making earlier, that all the players have slightly different agendas. The Gulf states have slightly different agendas from the Turks. The Kurds have a very different agenda from the Turks. The Iraqis have an aligned agenda with the Iranians and with the Russians, but all of them have a different agenda from the U.S. and the French and the British and others who are involved there. Even the extremist groups aren't aligned there. You have ISIS or Daesh fighting on one side, but you have Jabhat al-Nusra and al-Qaeda spinoff that's there, and they're rivals of ISIS. All that says is you've really got to be very careful about setting your priorities. And a political solution is one step. Defeating ISIS is another. And then you're going to have to figure out how to stabilize and rebuild the country, which is going to cost tens of billions, perhaps over $100 billion, which is another great challenge. My guess is that this is an issue that is not going to be resolved for another 5 or 10 years. If that, this is going to remain open because the interests of all of these parties are so misaligned with one another, and the resolve to do the big things that they need to do politically and economically in order to stabilize this country is so weak.
Just a very brief follow-up, and that's with regard to Bashar al-Assad. If, as President Obama and many Western leaders say, that Bashar al-Assad is the root or the origin of the problem, why have the so-called friends of Syria, in your view, not acted simultaneously to degrade his regime?
Well, because frankly, I think they weren't sure that they'd wanted to. I mean, the reality is Barack Obama cares about the plight of the people in Syria. I'm not saying that he doesn't, but he also doesn't want to intervene. If you don't want to intervene, then what do you want? You want stability. If you want stability, then you've got to evaluate what's the fastest path to stability. Having a functioning government in Damascus is a fast path to stability. And I think a couple of years ago, the United States sort of went off of the primary goal is to get Assad out and onto the primary goal is to put down ISIS. And once you say the primary goal is to put down ISIS, then you start saying, well, maybe we should keep Assad around a while and we can can work a transition out later. And so it's a deal with the devil, literally in this case, because, you know, there have been few world leaders in recent past who have inflicted so much damage on so many people with such high and grievous human cost as Bashar al-Assad, who ultimately has to go.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is David Rothkopf. He's CEO and editor of the Foreign Policy Group. His most recent book is National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Alphonse Nkongolu from the Congo. If you want to hear your name on the show, send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us on Facebook. Well, back to you, David Rothkopf. One more question with regard to Syria. Are you confident in the so-called Vienna process? Do you think that that can eventually bring about a solution?
A solution to what? You know, a solution to all the problems Syria faces? No. A solution that will stabilize Syria? No. A solution that's in the best interests of the 6 to 7 million dislocated Syrians or that will bring the refugees back to Syria? No. But having said that, can they come up with a political deal that, you know, sort of works on getting Assad out and starting a process that has some fig leaf of democratic process in it? Yeah, and I'll tell you what the deal is. Assad will stay in power for some period of time. He will then leave power at the end of that period of time, probably a few years. He will then go off and he'll get a free pass to live on the Black Sea or someplace, and he will never be prosecuted for his crimes. Another regime will come in. That other regime will look a lot like the Assad regime. We'll have people from the Assad regime. We'll have a lot of the Alawites represented in it. It will have a process in place that should give Sunnis and others more representation. The process probably won't work very well. But by then, everybody who's negotiated this deal will be in another job, with the possible exception of Vladimir Putin, the Ayatollahs in Tehran, and the members of the Assad regime who managed to hang on.
Exactly. And that leads me to just a quick comment. Countries like Russia and Iran, they have advantages over the countries of the free world, democracies. We have to consult parliaments, Congress, be receptive to polls, whereas Vladimir Putin and the Ayatollahs do not. They can promote their own narratives.
That's true. They also have strategy. They're also thinking about the long term. We are not thinking about the long term. It gives you a huge advantage if you're thinking a few moves ahead. They're playing chess. We're playing checkers.
David Rothkopf, let's move briefly to the Iran deal. I'd like to get your view of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, this historic agreement which was reached with Iran by the so-called P5 plus one earlier this year. Of course, President Obama sees this as a signature achievement, even over the objections, of course, of many members of Congress, both Republican and Democratic, and of course, the ally Israel and many Sunni Gulf states. What's your view of the deal?
You know, I think it's like many things that take place on the international stage. It's got some elements of good and some elements that are somewhat troubling. Is it better to have a deal to limit Iran's ability to get a nuclear weapon? Absolutely. Does the deal help to do that? Absolutely. Therefore, is it in at least the short term somewhat helpful in reducing a risk? Yes. Now, is the greatest risk that Iran poses to the Middle East its nuclear program? No, I don't think it is. And if it's not, what is the risk? The risk is that Iran wants to engage itself and play in the affairs of lots of other states. It's the largest state sponsor of terror in the world. So if that's the primary risk, how does the deal affect that? Well, if the deal leads to tens of billions of dollars coming back into Iran, and Iran is going to be back at the world stage and gain a lot of influence, then it is going to make Iran more of a threat within its own region to those who see it as a threat. And indeed, if you look over the period of the Obama administration, no country in the Middle East has actually gained more than Iran. In fact, most of the countries have been weakened over the course of the past 6 or 7 years by conflict, internal problems, and Arab Spring, and so forth. But Iran now has footholds of greater influence in Iraq by far. It has maintained its foothold in Syria. It has significant influence in Lebanon. It's got a significant influence in Yemen. And it's going to be better off on the world stage by a dramatic amount. That's a problem. The deal also gives the Iranians the ability to move forward with missile programs and other kinds of programs that allow them to increase the conventional threat that they place to their neighbors over the course of this period of time. And there are provisions within the deal like snapbacks and things that say, well, if they step over the line instantly, these sanctions will be back in. It's just a fiction. It's not going to happen that way. First of all, it takes a long time to prove there's a misstep. And secondly, where will we be at that time? Will the Chinese be more dependent on Iranian oil? Will they be willing to go with it? Will the Russians be willing to go along with it? I doubt it. So the reality is it's well-intentioned. It has some positive effects, but it's really got some serious questions associated with it.
A quick follow-up about those serious questions and the concern about the windfall from sanctions being used to prop up terrorist groups in the region. You know, the Obama administration said that it would hold Iran to account regarding terrorist activities. But critics say that once sanctions relief occurs, that the United States would have little leverage over Iran. I mean, how do you see that?
The United States won't have very much leverage at all. First of all, terrorist activities tend to be covert. It's very hard to prove the connections that are associated. It's very hard to make the case if your sources are covert because you don't want to reveal your sources. We can do our own things covertly in response to that. But here's what's going to happen. You relieve the sanctions. Whose lives does that change? Well, it's good for the Iranian people, and why should they be punished? But a lot of businesses are going to go into Iran. They're already going. Businesses from Germany and France and Japan and China, and not tens of businesses or hundreds, but tens of thousands of businesses, and they're all going to have a deal with Iran. They're all going to have an investment. And each one of those is going to become an ambassador in their own country for better relations with Iran because they're not going to want to see their deals blown up. So the United States can do what it wants with the tools that it's got. But by reopening all of these commercial ties with Iran, you're essentially strengthening their network on many levels in many countries that's going to weaken anything the U.S. does in terms of its long-term impact.
Let me turn quickly to the issue of refugees, which you mentioned earlier. And we know that Turkey, of course, has hosted so many millions of refugees. And now the EU and Turkey have reached an agreement which would limit the refugees' travel to other European countries. And in exchange, of course, the EU is giving Turkey billions of dollars and a promise for accelerated negotiations toward EU accession. But back to the initial issue, David Rothkopf, what impact is this refugee crisis having not only on Europe, its inability to handle it in a coherent fashion? What does it say about the European project and even about the United States? To what degree did we inadvertently or unintentionally contribute to the flow of refugees?
Well, look, I don't think that the situation right now with refugees or Syria reflects very well on the state of the Western alliance in general. We talked earlier about the United States and its hesitation to get involved in Syria when it could have had a bigger difference earlier. There's been a lot of talk about the president talking about red lines and then blinking and not taking action and postponing action, even when members of his cabinet, Hillary Clinton, Leon Panetta, Bob Gates, David Petraeus, were all saying do something. He refused to do it. So lack of leadership is an issue. The Europeans have that problem, but it's compounded by the fact that they have a lack of coherence. Because the EU is structured in a way where foreign policy coherence or a single foreign policy was not a goal, and it has been unable to get a kind of real collaborative approach to dealing with these issues. And in fact, we've seen over the past few years three major challenges to the European experiment, as you referred to it, one of them being the financial crisis, which I thought was going to sort of kick them into coherence, but it actually didn't. Then you had Crimea and Ukraine, which you would have thought would kick them into coherence, and it hasn't. And now you've got this refugee crisis, and all of it's done is exacerbated some of the differences and revealed that the EU may have a common currency and it may have had a common sort of flow of goods and people within its borders, but it has not gotten its head around the fact that they have common interests and that they should act in a concerted fashion because a problem in France ends up being a problem in Germany. And so that's another issue. And what it does is it, you know, it lets things deteriorate till they become a crisis. And then the actions they take are either impotent, let's go and bomb terrorists without putting troops on the ground, or they're dangerous. And you mentioned one a moment ago that is dangerous. The EU went into Turkey and they said, we're going to give you $3 billion to keep the refugees down here. What did they do? They gave a $3 billion check to Erdogan, the leader in Turkey, as he is dismantling democracy in his country, crushing journalists, crushing dissent, and it came without conditions because we are so desperate
to keep the refugees out of the EU that we're now in the position of supporting a guy at precisely the moment we shouldn't be supporting him. This is what happens when you act too late. You end up coming up with deals and initiatives that have really significant and bad unintended consequences.
Well, speaking of acting too late, that leads us to the thesis of your book, which is National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. I'd like you to talk about what you think are the shortcomings of contemporary U.S. foreign policy.
I think the biggest shortcoming is we don't understand what our long-term national interests are. We've spent the past 15 years focusing on a threat that I would characterize as one of the last threats of the 20th century. You know, these are terrorist groups that are fighting against the advance of modernity in a region of the world that is still struggling with the after effects of colonialism. And while these are important issues and they need to be addressed, we need to sort of push them down the priority list a little more because the world's on the verge of massive change. You know, we're a few years away from the moment where every human being on the planet Earth is connected in a man-made system for the first time by virtue of their cell phones. That's going to change identity, community, governance, education, healthcare, the nature of money, the nature of economics. It's going to raise questions about what is value, what are our rights. If you were going to write a constitution, it would look differently in that world. The nature of war is changing. The nature of peace is changing. Cyber conflict goes on all the time and raises tensions in important ways. The nature of public-private partnerships are changing. The nature of power is changing. Well, if all of that's changing, we ought to be dealing with that. But instead, we're dealing with a group like ISIS, which is 30,000 people, the size of a small junior college in the Midwest of the United States, that has very limited capability. And as soon as we eliminate ISIS one way or another, another such group will crop up. We have to have long-term strategy. We don't. We've also got our priorities completely screwed up. I mentioned earlier, you know, there was a candidate for president who said, how can the president deal with minor issues like climate change when there's big issues like terrorism coming up? This is ridiculous, right? This is the environment of the planet Earth. Hundreds of millions of people will be affected by sea level rises and extreme weather, and many, many more people will die or suffer consequences of climate change than will ever suffer the consequences of terrorism. But, you know, if we really care about U.S. national security, and national security means protecting American lives, then the place you want to begin is gun control in the United States, where you've got 30,000 people dying of gun violence in the United States, which is, you know, the same roughly as the total of all the people who die of terrorism in the world each year. You want to deal with national security in the United States? Reform drug laws in the United States, which lead to millions of people being incarcerated and lead to a lot of the violence that I was just talking about. You want to fix U.S. national security? Let's deal with the big rivals that are emerging in the world and figure out how do you deal with a country like China, which is not an enemy like Russia. It's actually a country that we're deeply integrated with in terms of huge number of interests. How do you develop a doctrine of interdependence and bring the Indians in more and find new kinds of balance if that's what we want to do to offset Chinese issues? These are the big issues. We don't even get around to talking about them. We have people in Washington who are obstructionists to whomever is in the opposite party, regardless of whatever they're proposing, that is weakening us. And we have a dysfunctional government that is making it impossible for us to even take the actions that we need to take overseas. These are critical issues. And unless we deal with these, we are guaranteed to have a panoply of the kind of questions that now arise internationally to deal with in years to come, and I actually think the risks will grow.
And do you think the United States does have a special role in terms of leadership on the world stage, and are you optimistic or not?
The U.S. definitely has a role to play. The richest and most powerful family in any community has a special role to play in that community. Does that mean that the United States should be dominant? No. Does it mean the United States should recognize it has special responsibilities thanks to the special blessings that it has had and thanks to the interdependence it has with the rest of the world? Yes.
David Rothkopf is CEO and editor of Foreign Policy Magazine and author of the recently published book, National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. David Rothkopf, thank you so much for your unique insights.
Thanks.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Gary Jaffe. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.